As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, exciting day in college football on Wednesday. The networks released their kickoff times, their selections for some of the early season games and you know, some of the bigger games throughout the season. And we want to welcome back a guest we had a little bit ago on the podcast, Derek Crocker, who is the person at Fox who schedules the games. Who better to debrief us on some of the big announcements that were made? Derek, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me back. I'm a huge fan of you guys.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time. This is like having the wizard behind the curtain for us. So many questions. I don't know, Stu, we've been covering the sport for a long time, but this has always been kind of a very intriguing part of how the process, you know, you kind of know what games you think you'll have, but then to see it actually unfold, it's fascinating.
And Stu, it's a lot different this year because because Fox now has the Big Ten. And so you're seeing, I think some fans who maybe didn't realize that saw the announcement come out and go, wait a minute, the Ohio State-Michigan game is on Fox? Wow. So why don't we start there, Derek? Well, first of all, a two-part question here. For the most part, people are used to, you know, they get into the season and they got to wait, you know, 12-day notice, sometimes 6-day notice to know which the selections the TV networks made. How are you able to announce certain games like Ohio State-Michigan before the season? And most importantly, how is that game, which has been on ABC for so long, how did it get on Fox?
So the first part of your question is we decided to pre-announce some of those matchups like Ohio State-Michigan, like Notre Dame-Michigan State, Bedlam, Penn State-Ohio State, primarily because as part of the draft process, we have the number one overall selection in each of those conferences in that particular week. So we felt comfortable in selecting those particular high-end games to really showcase, you know, what we believe, and you mentioned the Big Ten, and what we think is the best schedule that we've ever had in our history, and we really want to showcase just the strength of our lineup, and really show that, you know, we're going to have just a tremendous slate as we go throughout the season. And then the second part of Ohio State Michigan and how, you know, that one particular game ended up on our air. I think Commissioner Delaney has, you know, said in the past that Fox owns the overall number one selection. So, you know, it's not probably a genius that you have to assume that, you know, that game last year was the most watched game of a college football season. Obviously the rivalry and the tradition. So it was almost a no-brainer for us.
Okay, so just to be clear for people who might not understand it, there is a draft that takes place among the networks for each conference, and you're saying that in the Big Ten deal, the new Big Ten deal with Fox and ESPN, Fox has basically the number one, kind of like in the NFL draft, the number one overall pick.
That's correct.
I have a question for you, Derek. So this is obviously self-serving. You know, we both work at Fox. I work on Fox college football broadcasts. But what's different, not just the Big Ten aspect, but how have the other deals kind of changed in terms of we have also obviously the Pac-12 and the Big 12, which we've had before, in terms of where we pick on those games per week? Is it a similar deal with the Big 12 and Pac 12 as it has been in the previous years, or is it a little different this year as well?
No, it's the same. Each individual year, there's the draft order changes slightly between the various conference television partners, but for the most part, in terms of the equitable, how the draft goes throughout the process, it's the same. So the same number of games, the same type of pick structure, that doesn't change. One thing that's by adding, the Big Ten Conference, is that throughout the whole season, we will have number one picks in each of those conferences throughout the season.
How often, is it as simple as one week we have the number one pick in the Pac-12 and the other week ESPN has it, and the same deal with the Big 12, or is it a little more complicated than that?
A little bit more complicated than that, because it's obviously a draft process. So kind of going back to what Stu was saying earlier, is it's kind of like playing fantasy football or an NFL draft. So as you have, say, the number one selection, Ohio State, Michigan, you're picking not necessarily that particular game, but you're picking the number one selection on that particular date. So as you go through each of the conference drafts, you're selecting, 11-25, the first pick, we're selecting 9-16 as a second pick, so on and so forth, as you kind of get to the end of your total game counts.
So why don't we start from the top here, because you were able to announce the first 3 or 4 weeks of games. Let's look at week one, Thursday night, the 31st, Tulsa, Oklahoma State on FS1. In general, obviously the Thursday, Friday night games throughout the season get announced ahead of time. It's not like you find out on 2 weeks' notice that your game's going to move to Thursday. How does that come about? Like, does Fox approach Oklahoma State and say, would you be interested in playing a game on Thursday, or the conference sets that? How did that end up being the opening Thursday night game?
Yeah, that was a collective effort between Oklahoma State and Tulsa to agree to move from Saturday to Thursday. That happens with any of the non-conference games that you see, basically that end up on a Thursday or Friday. There has to be some kind of collective agreement to move games from Saturday to Thursday or to a Friday of that opening weekend.
In that vein, we have a pretty compelling matchup on the Sunday, which is typically a wide open day, and it was Texas A&M at UCLA because NFL hasn't started yet, and I know ESPN also has West Virginia, Virginia Tech that day. When you guys talk, do people want to jump into that slot because they know you're going to get way more visibility on a Sunday than you will when you have so many other games? I mean, how either receptive are they? Do schools come up? And because I know coaches like it because they get that window.
It's a combination of things. I think every school treats it a little bit differently. If you look at, games that traditionally have been played on that Sunday in years past, they've done typically better than a game on a Saturday. So I think in particular this one game, the schools saw the opportunity to be able to schedule a game in prime time on Fox broadcast on a date, which you mentioned, doesn't typically have strong competition.
And that was something that really started to take hold last year with the Texas Notre Dame game that did so well on ESPN. Now you can just see, as soon as that happened, you realize like we're going to be seeing this more and more. And so now this year we've got dueling Sunday night primetime games. In terms of Saturday, you've got four games between Big Fox and FS1. You've got at noon, Maryland at Texas, the Tom Herman debut, FS1. 3:30, these are all Eastern, UTEP at Oklahoma on Big Fox. 7:30 in prime time on Big Fox, Purdue, Louisville at Lucas Oil Stadium, Lamar Jackson and Jeff Brohm's first game at Purdue. 10:30
against his old school.
Against his old school, and then 10:30, Montana State at Washington State on FS1. When this came out, I saw a few people ask, wait a minute, why isn't the Maryland-Texas game on Big Fox and the UTEP-Oklahoma game on FS1?
So I think in particular, the Maryland-Texas game, obviously with Tom Herman in his first game, we really wanted to put it in the best time slot that we felt could showcase to the most amount of viewers. So we take a lot of different factors into place. And in the particular, if you look at the competitive landscape on the day, The noon Eastern slot felt like for us is the best time slot to be able to put that game in and showcase across the country. So that was in particular that game. While UTEP Oklahoma was on Fox broadcast, I think in general, we wanted to showcase, some of the biggest brands, some of the best players, across the country. And obviously Baker Mayfield is a huge story in prime time, Purdue playing Louisville, with Lamar Jackson and his first game, the Heisman Trophy winner. Those were all compelling storylines for us.
And to that point about the competition, that it kind of makes sense when you look at the greater lineup that day. Maryland, Texas will be opposite Akron, Penn State, Bowling Green, Michigan State, and Kent State, Clemson. Whereas the 3:30 window that where UTEP, Oklahoma is got to go up against Florida, Michigan, and Temple, Notre Dame. So regardless of whether it's on cable or broadcast, obviously, probably more people are going to see the Texas-Maryland game at the time slot that it is.
Derek, do we know which crews are doing these games yet?
That's a very self-interest question.
Unfortunately, that's not my job. But
next week's guest,
to Judy Boyd on that one.
Next week on the Audible, we welcome on Judy Boyd.
Okay,
let's. Bruce, you want to move to September 9th?
I do. So we have last year Stanford and USC, things really started to turn for USC after this game. That is the biggest game. But the game I wanted to ask you about is actually before that, and it's a 4:30 game. It's on Fox and Fox Deportes. It is Nebraska at Oregon. There's some nice buzz about Nebraska going in. Oregon obviously is rebuilding through Willie Taggart. Stu and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday. When we started 3 years ago, this would have been like one of the biggest, bigger games that we would have had, like more marquee name. And here it is where it's like
the undercard.
Yeah, really of that, which is kind of speaking to the direction of how much the brand has grown in this space in college football. I mean, even the FS2 game that day at noon, East Carolina at West Virginia, that probably would have been a mid-level game for us. Now it's on FS2. It just kind of speaks to the direction. When you guys are juggling all this stuff, how much flexibility do you have when it comes to, okay, this is going to go to FS2. Because I know also you start to run into other issues. You have baseball. Sometimes you have UFC stuff, right? So does that get really complicated once you get past this date? Or is this at this point, week two, you still have a lot of flexibility?
No, you're right. There's a ton of factors, like I've mentioned before, whether it's, just having the type of inventory that we do now have with, with adding the Big Ten and, along with these marquee games, non-conference in the Pac-12, and then also in the Big 12 with East Carolina, West Virginia, having that type of quality, are good problems to have, honestly, for us. But we do have to factor in what we also have from our other television partners, whether it's the UFC, like you mentioned, whether it's Major League Baseball. For instance, on Fox broadcast that day, we're going to have a Major League Baseball in the early afternoon leading into the Nebraska to Oregon window. So all those things factor in, and there's only a certain number of windows that we have on a certain day and a certain network.
I look at that September 9th, you've got Nebraska, Oregon, and Stanford, USC on Fox, and you've got Minnesota, Oregon State on FS1. I mean, given that the Pac-12 has deals with ESPN and Pac-12 Network, obviously, is there something about that week that you're able to get, I mean, it looks like there's no Big Ten game on Fox that day.
Well, there is the day before, though.
Ohio at Purdue on Friday night, right? And you've got a couple Big 12, but you got three. I mean, it's kind of a loaded day in the Pac-12. I just looked it up. There's also BYU Utah that day on ESPN and Boise State, Washington State. I mean, and Houston, Arizona, and San Diego State, Arizona State. I think I've just answered my own question of how the heck did you get these three decent Pac-12 games on the same day?
Yeah, no, you're right. It just ended the way, the school scheduled the non-conference games in this particular week. The Pac-12 was had some very strong marquee matchups. Does this happen every year? No, I think this is, I don't know if it's an anomaly either, but it's, you know, it's kind of a nice problem to have, honestly, on September 9th. And, you know, all the networks, you know, us and, you know, the other two Pac-12 network television partners were, you know, pretty aggressive in trying to schedule those games on some of our biggest networks.
Hey, Derek, I have a question here, and maybe this relates to what you were saying before about available windows. But so looking at October, we have on October 7th, three games on Big Fox, a triple header, a noon game, a 4 p.m. game, and an 8 p.m. All times are obviously Eastern. Then the next week, October 14th, there's four games on FS1. By the way, and that same Saturday, October 7th, in addition to the three games on Big Fox, there's four games on FS1. So that's seven games. Dawned on me, I don't even know if we have that many crews, but that's another story. But the next week, we don't have any games on Big Fox. We have four games on FS1. So is that simply a matter of, is that baseball taking that up, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we like I said before, we had to factor in all of our various, you know, programming commitments. And between October 7th and October 14th, you know, it's just a matter on October 14th, we have more commitments on that day than we do on October 7th. October 7th, we have basically open windows for college football. So we were able to fill all of those windows with games. And this will be the first time I think we've ever had seven games between Fox Broadcast and FS1. And it also start October 7th will be the first time we've ever had a triple header of college football on Fox Broadcast. So I think that's an exciting day for us. And then the October 14th, the reason we don't have broadcast is just because we have other programming commitments, whether it could be a baseball game, it could be a NASCAR race, those kinds of things.
October 7th, seven games in one day, and all of which will have halftime shows. Ladies and gentlemen, tune in to see Rob Stone be on television continuously for 13 hours.
Well, do we also run the risk that day? Is this the day where we give America a solo Tim Brando broadcast to conserve our on-air talent? Just Tim gets the whole 4 hours?
How about Tim calls the noon game and then we fly him out to the 11 p.m. Pac-12 game?
I guess that chuckle means no. Okay. Well, sorry, Tim. We were trying on your behalf for more airtime, but I guess that's
September 16th, the big one, a prime time, Texas-USC. You mentioned in the Big Ten, you know, you're able to get Michigan-Ohio State before the season because of the draft order. This would seem like it would have been also one of those very high up preseason choices.
It was. You know, I think that, you know, along with all the games in the first 3 weeks that we chose, whether it's Texas A&M, UCLA, Stanford, USC, Nebraska, Oregon, Texas, USC, all those games were pretty high draft picks. But the reason we can announce, you know, all those games on September 16th is because across all the various conferences, the first 3 weeks are pre-announced, as you saw yesterday. So that's why you see games September 16th announced, but maybe not all the games on September 23rd announced.
So with all due respect, Derek, so now we have games for the first 3 weeks of the season, then we get to the fourth week of the season. We have a Friday game at Utah at Arizona, and then there's a Saturday, one of the Big Fox games is already decided, Notre Dame at Michigan State, but then we have a bunch of to be announced. Since there are not going to be any results for the next, you know, 2 months or so, what do you do between now and then?
Working on college basketball. Literally, like right before you guys, we jumped on the phone to have this podcast. As I was talking with a colleague of mine about Big Ten basketball, actually. So just one thing rolls into the next for us.
I mean, that must be, you know, you've added, you know, a certain number of football games this year with the Big Ten coming on. But my gosh, we must have just like, I don't know if you know the exact number off the top of your head, but so many more basketball games now.
We do. I mean, I think just in totality of adding the Big Ten conference and then in combination with, you know, our current partners, I don't want to, you know, discredit them, the Pac-12 and the Big 12 and the Big East in men's basketball and men's women's basketball. I think in totality, it's just a huge step forward for us, you know, with all the various conference partners now that we have. We think that our lineup, especially in the college football, stacks up with, you know, with any of our competitors now.
Hey, last thing, Derek. your job, since I've kind of gotten to know you and watched you do this, like, just seems like so much fun. Like, I would think any college football fan, like you described it, like fantasy football, basically, would love to do this. How does one become a college football scheduler for a network?
Great question. I think it's, you know, it's a combination of, you have to have, you know, definitely a passion for college sports. That's first and foremost. You know, if you don't love watching college football on a Saturday or every day of the week watching college basketball, you know, the job's going to get very mundane. But if you really love, you know, the passion and rivalries and, you know, things that you guys love and most of the college sports world loves, this job's extremely appealing. I got there through, basically I was an intern here at Fox, and just luckily, you know, I started at the very bottom as an assistant in the larger programming group. And one of my first jobs was, to work, on the college football schedules. And I always gravitated, more to the, towards the college side than any of our other, you know, partners or sports that we cover. So, it was more of just a natural progression for me, you know, to kind of really focus my efforts on the college football space and college basketball space. So, and I've loved it ever since.
How much arguing? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think it's just a combination of a little bit of luck, honestly, and then just having the passion, you know, for the, you know, for your job.
How much arguing and debating is going on, you know, in the offices, like when this process, not on the basketball side, but at least on the college football side, to get to this point within Fox, is it a lot, or are you guys pretty much saying, okay, this is how it's going to play out? Because obviously you have to anticipate what other people may have value on. So are you, when you do this, do you know what their schedule? Because obviously people know that Fox has the World Series. People know how that, you know, Fox is invested big in UFC. So there's some other factors you're going to have to juggle around. Do you guys look at it, especially when you're competing against ESPN, which has, you know, a lot of real estate there to fill? I mean, is it looked at differently?
I mean, I think just in general, you know, Fox as a whole, we have a very bullish mindset on college sports, evidenced by, you know, now having the Big Ten Conference. So in terms of deciding, you know, where games are chosen, there's definitely a lot of debate, you know, between our group. I think it's, you know, I think to get the best schedule, you have to have debate. You have to, you know, really dive down into the details to figure out what is the best schedule for your own particular network. And so our needs could be potentially different than what our competitors' needs are.
Well, you guys can find the schedule. Well, I mean, I guess you could Google it. You can find that pretty easily. Where else? Fox Sports PR Twitter account.
Yes, and I think Stu and I have both each tweeted this out. You can find it on our Twitter feeds as well.
And then there's some great sites out there that if you want to see the whole, you know, with all of the networks combined, if you want to see, like, where the TV schedule is at this point, or, you know, once we get into the season and they are announcing games 12 days or 6 days ahead of time. This is actually my favorite one, lsufootball.net/TV schedule. It's an LSU football site, but for whatever reason, they decided to start doing the authoritative college football TV schedule for the whole country. That's my recommendation there. Derek, repeat guest. We have a t-shirt we sent. No, we don't really have anything to give you, unfortunately, but we appreciate your time, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate your time as well.
Thank you, Derek.
All right, thanks to Derek for coming on. I was just kind of, when the schedule came out, it kind of, I don't know about you, it just kind of like got the juices flowing, like, oh yeah, college football is almost here. You know, now we have actually some, you know, we can actually look and see, well, these are the games I'll be watching weeks 1, 2, and 3.
I know. I mean, it becomes real, and that's a cool thing, because we spend so much time in the minutia and speculating on this and that and spring football stories and whatever. So it's a good thing. Ready for the mailbag?
Let's do it.
It's the mailbag from a computer, so not literally a bag, but just mail.
This question is from Trevor Yardley. Hi, guys. Love the show. Thank you, Trevor. I had this thought during the bowl season, but never got around to emailing you. Do you think it would be beneficial for everybody if the Group of Five became their own division, had their own championship game? I would love it, and I think it would bring more excitement to those teams rather than playing in cheesy bowl games.
So that idea has been proposed by the athletic director at NIU, Sean Frazier, and it has been pretty universally shot down by people involved in the Group of Five conferences. But I like it, you know, but I'm a realist. Those teams are never going to make the playoff. They're going to become increasingly marginalized.
Never say never, Stu.
They're not. You know, I suppose if Houston had gone undefeated last year. I mean,
Houston could have. You can't say never. They're most likely not going
to. They're 99% most likely not going to make the playoff. And as so, like he says, you know, I mean, look, a lot of teams have moved up from FCS to FBS and given up, you know, playing for a national championship to playing to get into the Dollar General Bowl. But I would just think, you know, you see how poor, how awful the attendance is at some of the, like, the MAC games, the MAC weeknight games and whatnot. I just think people would be more engaged if their teams were actually playing for a championship.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know. I'm kind of conflicted on this, I'll be honest. You know, when I look at the team that probably off top of my head, who I think is, who has, you know, good momentum, has a chance to make a run at, you know, the top 10. You know, I look at USF, what Charlie Strong inherits. The only thing is, when you look at what their schedule is, unlike Houston, where they had, you know, some marquee games, non-conference, that's not where USF is right now. So I think it's just so many things have to come into play.
Well, the main thing is there has to be an acceptance that I fully understand is tough. Like, you are basically admitting that you're inferior. And I don't think most, you know, these guys are competitors. They don't want to, like, just
it would gladly
officially accept second tier status. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the way it is now more than the other way. I guess I do. So
that's fair enough. We keep getting emails about that, Athlon top 50 of the last 50 years. I guess it's a great discussion point. Ryan, who is a Gators fan, it should be noted. Bruce and Stu, hold on a minute. So both of you had Peyton Manning ranked above Danny Werfel in your rankings, and of course Manning ended up above Werfel in the final list as well. Is this more on what Manning did in the NFL? Because Werfel was by far the better player in college. The only stat that Manning has over Werfel in college is career passing yards. Werfel has more touchdowns, better passer rating, better yards per attempt, more SEC championships, 4, more national titles, 1, and beat Manning head-to-head all 3 times they faced each other. Pretty convincing argument.
Yeah, look, I think this is, you know, I would have had a Johnny Manziel above both of them. You know, I mean, he's making a good point. Like, I was not huge on Peyton Manning here either. So I wasn't huge on Danny Werfel. By the way, you could have Gino Toretta on there if you want to start throwing them on too.
Well, Danny Werfel at the time, you know, part of that Spurrier funding on offense, he was putting up stats that were rarely seen from quarterback, and he was leading them to those SEC titles. And yes, he always had Peyton Manning's number. So I guess it's possible that the Peyton Manning NFL factor, you know, I mean, Werfel wasn't an NFL quarterback. Peyton Manning was a great NFL quarterback. I mean, I don't know how that doesn't, you know, I don't know how that doesn't.
You didn't have Ty Detmer on that list, you know. I mean,
I don't know how that doesn't come into play. I don't know how you can just completely separate that out. You know, I think that's why Barry Sanders was so high. I think that's why Lawrence Taylor is so high. Is that possibly why Ronnie Lott is so high? You know, a lot of these guys, it's hard to separate their NFL from their college career.
It is. I mean, look, I made the case Anthony Munoz. I mean, he's arguably the greatest NFL offensive tackle in the history of the game. I don't know if he was that, you know, I don't think he was that way coming out of what he did at USC. Again, I mean, there's guys who had huge careers. I mean, Graham Harrell, we never mentioned him. Ty Detmer, never mentioned him. You know, Colt McCoy was another one.
Okay, next up. By the way, I didn't say it off the top. You can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Hey, guys. Oh, wait, it's your turn.
Hey, guys. Been hooked on the podcast for a few months. Can't wait to hear the analysis and breakdown when the season gets started. Some buddies and I got our undergrad degrees at CSU and CU Boulder, respectively. We don't know what real college football atmosphere is or looks like. We're thinking about taking a trip to see a big-time program college football game this year. What is one primetime matchup you're looking forward to seeing, college game day or non-conference, et cetera? What is the best tailgate fan experience, city fan base, food, et cetera? Thanks. Keep up the great work. Let me know if you ever need an intern. From Ben.
Well, to the second part, I always say for best tailgate experience, LSU. It's like going into another country almost. It's just so unique from anywhere else in college football. The accents are different. The cuisine is different. And they just take tailgating so seriously. So if that's what you're looking for, that would be my first choice.
Yeah.
And is the Alabama-LSU game there?
It's in Tuscaloosa.
Okay. But surely there will be some LSU primetime games. Well, we just talked about the schedule. Derek, what primetime matchup are you most looking forward to seeing?
The game I'm most looking forward to, and again, this is going to sound self-serving, but because there has been so much drama around Jim Harbaugh all year, and he still has yet to beat the school arch rival, Ohio State. That was a great game last year. Now it's not a primetime game. It's a noon game. But I think this is a must-win game. And considering they have so few returning starters back, that's going to be a tough hill to climb to beat a really talented, you know, veteran Ohio State team. But to me, that I start with that one just because of the two coaches and where they are. And quite frankly, when you look at, you know, how great Alabama has been, you know, I don't know who the next best team in the SEC is right now. I mean, do you feel like there's one that's a top five caliber right now? I don't think there is.
No. Here would be my suggestion to him. Now, the kickoff time has not been announced, but what about Florida State at Clemson? I mean, there's a very good chance that's going to be for a playoff spot. And I went to my first game in Death Valley last year. It is every bit worth the hype, or lives up to the hype, with the running down the hill and just, you know, it's just such a fantastic atmosphere. That is a great tailgating place. So you could check, I think he and his friends could check off all the boxes if they made it to that. Now, I don't know what kind of funds they have, because the kind of games we're talking about obviously will be quite a hot ticket.
Yeah, that is a great choice. I really think it, you know, it's going to be very compelling, awesome atmosphere, everything. Good one, Stu.
Okay, moving on to Clint. Hi, Stu and Bruce. It seems like every week we get a Baylor-related question. I understand why. Hey, Stu and Bruce, love the pod. Appreciate you guys talking college football every week, even though it's the off season. Not just every week, twice a week. A recent mailbag question asked about Baylor football, and in the wake of everything that has happened, would Baylor ever get rid of its football team? That got me to thinking. Do you think the NCAA will ever give out the death penalty again? I know after acting too quickly and overstepping its bounds in the Penn State scandal, they don't want to get involved with these criminal scandals again, but it just seems the things happening today are much worse than what happened at SMU.
I think Clint is right, but I don't think, just from everything we've heard from the NCAA and from people close to the NCAA, that they're gonna bring back the death penalty. So I don't see it happening. You know, I got to admit, whenever I see this, you know, this one, the part that seems to really piss me off a lot in the wake of the Baylor stuff is Liberty.
Yeah. You brought that up a few times.
As bad as things are at Baylor, and they are horrific, you know, the fact that Liberty turned around and hired Baylor AD and made the statements they did in the wake of it is shameful. You know, and it sucks that the NCAA just like kind of like, hey, waved him in to move up in college football and kind of went around some of their own protocols to do so.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the NCAA can't tell them who you should or shouldn't hire as your AD, but this happened at a time when they were deciding whether or not to let them move up to FBS and to do it in an accelerated timeline,
without,
I believe.
Without any conference affiliation.
That's what it was, without a conference affiliation, which is supposed to be the rule.
That's bullshit, and I think the NCAA needs to look in the mirror if they're going to be pious about anything like that. You know, and that's what you're associating with. Liberty, you know, Liberty doesn't give a shit about anything about decorum because they bring on that AD after what he did or what was connected to him, and I just think it's just a bad look all around. So, I agree with the tenor of Clint's thing, but just from what we know from the NCAA, the answer I think is going to be a no.
And I agree with him that obviously a situation like what happened at Baylor and what happened at Penn State, I mean, these are real life tragedies that far eclipse, you know, players getting a Cadillac or whatnot. Now, if you watched the SMU 30 for 30 a few years ago, because I didn't live through that era, so this was really my, you know, the best exposure I've had to what happened with SMU. If you can narrow your vision just to kind of conventional NCAA rules, the ones they actually are able to enforce, that's pretty egregious. You know, we haven't really seen anything like that in these in the modern era, where not only were they paying guys, but it was an organized system. They were they had it down on paper. When the coach left for the Patriots, he left it behind. Okay, here's what you owe to these guys. The NCAA stepped in once, penalized them for it, said don't do it again, and they kept doing it. And that's when the death penalty happened. So I'm not trying to compare it to Baylor or Penn State by any means, but in the grand, but if you want to, why did that case get this most severe of penalties? In terms of like extra benefits cases, I don't think anything comes close to that, and I don't think you'll see that again, because these schools have too much at stake and too much at risk. Another reason why you probably won't see the death penalty. I mean, not only did they have the death penalty then, you know, it was not uncommon. And I'm thinking the undefeated Auburn team with Terry Bowden, 1993, to give them a TV ban, or the year Andre Ware was won the Heisman, they were on a TV ban. There's no way you could do that now. You would, because these teams are on TV every single week. There's so much money tied to it, and you would also be penalizing the team that they'd be playing that week. So you can't do that, and I, for the same reason, I don't think you could realistically shut down a program. I mean, if you know, just be clear, I'm not saying Ole Miss deserves a death penalty by any means, but let's just say it turned out that things were 10 times worse than we thought, and they decided to give them the death penalty. That negatively impacts every other school in the SEC.
It does and it doesn't. I mean, if Ole Miss stopped playing college football for 2 years, I don't know if I think that actually would probably positively impact its arch rival.
Yeah, that would be the one school that would definitely be all for that. But, like, I mean, that's – unless they then turned around and replaced them with someone for 2 years, that's totally messes up your schedule. That's fewer conference games. That's fewer – you know, networks are paying for a certain number of conference games. It's possibly less bowl revenue. Look, I mean, I'm not saying, just like you said with the playoff, never say never. But, yeah, I'll say 99% sure there's not going to be another death penalty.
Yeah. Next question, Mike Osterreiter in Pennsylvania. A few episodes you guys talked about coaches, quote, going out on top and how few really do that. That got me thinking about successful coaches who are entrenched at their current schools, but still years from retirement. Names like Dan Mullen, Mike Gundy, and Ken Niumatalolo come to mind. What is their next career stop for guys like this? I can't see a guy like Mullen riding off into the sunset at Mississippi State.
Well, Mullen and Gundy have certainly tried to leave at various times. And in Mullen's case, he just...
A lot, yeah.
Yeah, like, he just can't get the jobs. Like, I don't know, you know, we've heard it at least in one occasion where he just kind of rubbed people the wrong way, but it just seems like he talks to schools and then they end up passing on him.
Yeah. And Gundy, you know, there's been friction with the administration. I'd be surprised if Mike Gundy doesn't end up someplace else sooner than later. You know, he's done a really good job there. They have a really good team, but I just think, sooner or later, there's going to be a pretty big job that he will get, that he will go off to. I don't know if it's going to be a Big 12 job or an SEC job. I would guess it's going to be one of those two, though. Kenny Amatolo is a little different in terms of, you know, BYU, there was interest, and some of the things that went in that were involved, if he were to be the head coach, I think were non-starters from what I've heard. So that didn't happen. I could see... You know, those guys are so far removed from retirement that I think they will all have second act somewhere.
The first two I agree with. It seemed like BYU was, I mean, it was the one school that would have made a lot of sense for him for many reasons. He even, I mean, it was one of the you know, more unique courtships I've seen where it was just completely out in the open. Like, he announced after the Army-Navy game, oh, yeah, I'm going to go interview there and see what it's like, and then went there for a couple of days, then came back, decided not to take it. You know, now you think, like, next year, three years, I don't know, he's going to turn around and go to where?
Somewhere in the Pac-12.
Okay.
I think he would be intrigued somewhere in the Pac-12, and he would be able to recruit some other kids because of his connections out on the Pacific Northwest and maybe out in Hawaii as well and in American Samoa. And I think you'd probably see get a better sense of just how I don't know how good of a coach he is, because we know he's a really good coach.
So let's say Jim Mora gets fired and he gets the UCLA job. Is he going to run the triple option at UCLA?
No, I don't think he would. I think he would run something a little different.
That's where it's so hard to forecast for him, because that is what he's had so much success with. I realize it's not like his whole career he has done that. I mean, he does that because of the school he's at and having learned it from Paul Johnson. But, I mean, that would be just be whatever he ends up doing. I guess he could, you know, a lot of the modern spread offenses borrow heavily from those concepts anyway, but that's why it's hard for me to see him leaving to some sort of powerhouse, perceived powerhouse, at least school like that. I always thought if he left, it would be for something that he had a particular personal connection to, like BYU.
Yeah, look, one of the people I think is the smartest, one of the three or four smartest people I know in football, thinks Ken Niumatalolo is like the smartest football coach he knows.
He may well be right about that.
So we'll see. It's a good question.
Gordon Cameron, Burlington, Ontario. Good day, gentlemen. With the benefit of hindsight, what were some of the worst coaching firing decisions ever made in college football? Are there any at the time of the firing and or the hiring of his replacement that seems so boneheaded that it just left you gobsmacked?
I have one on this that came right to mind, and because it kind of hits close to home just because I spent a bunch of time there. And that would be David Cutcliffe getting booted by Ole Miss. Now, this goes back to Pete Boone, who was, and I've said this before on the podcast, about the only thing that David Cutcliffe, the guy who followed him, Ed Ogeron, the guy who followed him, Houston not have in common, aside, I guess, from them all being white men, is that they all did not really like Pete Boone, the AD they had. And David Cutcliffe, 1 year removed from leading Ole Miss to a 10-3 season and top 15 finish, went 4-7 and got fired. I mean, it was just, and this is, keep in mind, Ole Miss had a lot of recent history before Cutcliffe with scandals. And you got a very straight shooter, clean cut guy who knew the SEC, and they ran him out of there. And he's done a very, very good job at Duke. And, you know, look, I mean, I think that was a boneheaded move by Ole Miss.
That was going to be my first answer as well. I mean, they spent a decade basically trying to get back to the perch that he led them to. I think another one would be Nebraska firing Frank Solich. I don't know if he would have continued to be their coach for another 15 years like he has been at Ohio, but they had gone to the national championship game, you know, what, 2001. Then they had a very uncharacteristic year by Nebraska standards the next year, and that's when he started to feel the heat. Then he goes 9-3. Now, we have seen more recently some coaches get fired for going 9-3. He got fired for going 9-3, and just compounded by the fact that Steve Peterson, the AD at the time, a not well-regarded AD in the industry, replaced him with Bill Callahan. That was one of the all-time worst coaching changes I think you could have.
Come on now. You got close to the fire now. I heard you throw the name Steve Peterson out there. There's somebody else you're leaving off that needs to be thrown into the discussion.
Go ahead.
Don't play dumb, Stu. Come on.
You're saying another coach that worked for him in another school that doesn't have a favorable opinion of him?
Yeah, and come on now, another coach, kind of charismatic, reeks of cigar smoke from time to time.
Yeah, I would say that there have been plenty of people, himself, that person included, that
was fired after winning 26 games in the previous 3 years and going 15-6 in his conference. And was fired.
So it seems like Steve Peterson's common thread is he has a short leash. He fires guys as soon as it starts to go south, and then he just has a terrible, terrible track record with who he replaces them with.
Yeah.
Let me give you one other one. You may disagree, but when I wrote my book, now 10 years ago, I had a whole chapter about this kind of stuff, and this is one of the examples I used, and that was Minnesota firing Glenn Mason, who led them to, I mean, Minnesota had been awful for years before he got there. I'm looking at now led them to, by the time he got fired, he had led them to 5 straight bowl games. He went 10-3 in 2003. And if you recall, there wasn't even really any notion that he would be fired until they blew the biggest lead in bowl history to your guy Leach in the Insight Bowl, and then he got fired. And replaced with Tim Brewster.
Yeah, I know. That's the rubbing salt in the eyes of the Minnesota fans. Yeah, that's a good one. That is a good one. I have a question for you on this one. This guy did a terrific job where he was, but, you know, in the last couple of years, he really ran out of gas. But he was at Syracuse for, I don't know, 17 years, 15 years. Paul Pasqualoni, was it time just to move on, or was that something they should have let him keep coaching?
You know, now that's one of those things where, you know, given where Syracuse is now, it's, you know, easy to go back and say, well, how the heck could you have fired a guy who went, won the Big East three straight years at one point with Donovan McNabb, 10-3 in 2001, but then after that, 4-8, 6-6, 6-6. I can't say that I fault them for that, even though that was another one where the replacement made it that much worse. Remember who they replaced him with?
Yes. Pete Carroll's guy. Oh, God. He was at Texas. Greg Robinson. Yeah.
Greg Robinson, who was a total disaster there. Pasqualoni resurfaced a few years ago at UConn, and that did not go well either.
In the short term, here's one that like I thought of too came up. Tony Levine, 3 years. They pulled the plug fast. Now, they did bring in to grab Tom Herman.
Yeah, that one worked out well for them.
Helps.
Yeah.
But when you're 3 years and you know, have a winning record, I don't know. That was another one that came to mind. And not quite like the Cutcliffe one. Like I think that one stood out to me. Again, like I said, it hit close to home. I feel like we're missing a couple of
Once this goes out, people are going to remind us about, like, we're kind of talking about guys who were good coaches, but, like, not national championship coaches by any means. And I think people are going to remind us about sometime in the 60s when some coaching icon got fired and the school lived to regret it. But off the top of my head, Woody Hayes got fired for punching a player. You know, a lot of really great coaches. Yeah, got something
like,
off the...
I mean, look, yeah. You mentioned Leach before. Leach got fired at Texas Tech. I mean, the program hadn't been the same since he left either.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and please subscribe to The Audible on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next time.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.